This is Sasha.
And this is Eli. And you're listening to WGXC Acra.
To get a local event mentioned on All Together Now, go to WGXC.org and click on Add an Event at the top of the page. And copy and paste the information about your event in the boxes. Let's all get involved in our community. See what's going on at WGXC.org in the community calendar. If you have a press release for All Together Now, send it to news at WGXC.org. And our crack community reporters will see if we can mention your news on the local airwaves on the collaborative 6 p.m. local radio news show, All Together Now.
WGXC underwriting support is provided by the First Presbyterian Church of Hudson, a faith community open to all. Whether you are single, married, divorced, gay, wealthy, poor, or no habla inglés, if you are just browsing, just woke up, or just got out of jail, it doesn't matter if you work on Wall Street or if you sleep on Wall Street, you belong. We love soccer moms, crying babies, vegans, hipsters, seekers and doubters, tourists and locals. All are welcome. Services held Sunday mornings at 10:45 a.m. You can find us on the web at firstpreshudson.org.
Network, this is the news. This is the network. This is the news. This is the network. Network in sports.
You've tuned in to All Together Now, WGXC's local news show for the Hudson Valley and the Capital Region, from the Catskills to the Berkshires and beyond. Today, Jake Ashby, the Republican assemblyperson in the 107th District, covers Columbia County and Rensselaer County, will be interviewed from our partner station WOOCLP in Troy. They'll also take us on a tour of the Water Resources Institute on today's edition of All Together Now.
This is the news. This is the network. Network.
On air, in air, waves.
Controlled.
On air, in air, channel.
Connection.
And the moon turns to blood.
We interrupt this broadcast to bring you a special news bulletin.
Stay tuned to this station.
Stand by for news.
Direct via satellite from our on-the-spot task force.
Good evening from our newsroom in New York.
This is
Daily News and Weather Report.
We take you now to
this radio broadcast.
You are tuned in to All Together Now, a collaborative one-hour news show for community radio stations in the Capital Region and New York's Hudson Valley. All Together Now features contributions from the public, along with programmers at WOOC in Troy and WGXC in Acre, featuring local and regional news, weather updates, and newsmaker interviews. Next, the national headlines from Public News Service.
The Public News Service Daily Newscast for Tuesday, September the 25th, 2018. I'm Mike Clifford. The list of accusers against Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh continues to swell. Also on the Tuesday rundown, Hurricane Florence snaps North Carolina to attention on the importance of food benefits. Plus, a new report says young parents need better supports. Topping our news, it was a roller coaster day of new developments on Monday. New accusers are now alleging sexual misconduct allegations against Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh. He represents a woman with credible information regarding Judge Kavanaugh and his friend, Mark Judge. Quoting Avenatti, will be demanding the opportunity to present testimony to the committee and will likewise be demanding that Judge and others be subpoenaed to testify. Meantime, at this hour, a major question mark remains over whether the original accuser, Christine Blasey Ford, will testify before the Senate Judiciary Committee on Thursday. This week, members of Congress expected to release a compromised version of the Farm Bill that could impact the future of the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program for people in North Carolina and the rest of the country. Stephanie Carson explains why it's further complicating things for people in the eastern part of the state.
It comes at a time when the food assistance program is sustaining residents of eastern North Carolina, still confronting the devastation of Hurricane Florence. Jessica Wichard with the Food Bank of Central and Eastern North Carolina says her organization serves 600,000 people, and the uncertainty around the SNAP program isn't helping.
When people have already been struggling with food and then after a storm hits, to be concerned about losing those benefits at the same time, it just kind of magnifies the devastation that exists for them.
In advance of the storm, the state's Department of Health and Human Services temporarily modified food assistance rules to make food more accessible to people as they confront loss of power, water, and shelter. On Monday, Governor Roy Cooper called for a special state assembly session to discuss relief efforts. While it's unclear what Congress will propose in the new version of the Farm Bill, the House version included significant cuts to the program that Wichard and others say could be devastating.
And Talking Points memo reports after a tumultuous morning of conflicting reports that he was resigning or maybe fired. It appears Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein will stay in his current position for at least a few more days. They report speculation that Rosenstein was about to be ousted from the number two spot reached a fever pitch as he headed to a White House meeting on Monday that had been previously scheduled. A government watchdog group is calling Florida's growing system of privately run public charter schools corrupt and wasteful and wants policymakers to impose more rules on how charters spend their money.
Integrity Florida, a nonprofit group that seeks to uncover public corruption, claims many charter school operations have strayed from their original mission of showcasing innovation to help public schools. Ben Wilcox, the group's research director, says charters have become a parallel education system in Florida with hidden costs to taxpayers.
These hidden costs represent a corporate for-profit taxpayer scam that looks more like corporate welfare than it does public education.
Although all charter schools are nonprofits controlled by their own privately selected boards, nearly half of Florida's 650 charter schools are run by for-profit companies. Supporters of charter schools say the report is using a few bad apples to define all charter schools. I'm Tramell Gomes.
Meantime, the sleepless nights and increased costs that come with parenthood are a rude awakening for anyone, but Mary Sherman reports the challenge is often greater for young parents.
For some of South Carolina's young adults, the already challenging transition to adulthood is complicated by becoming a parent. And a report released today explores the unique opportunities to help young adult parents during this period of growth. 51,000 South Carolina kids have a parent between the ages of 18 and 24, and 69% of those children live in low-income families. Bette Williams with the Children's Trust of South Carolina says these young parents need help overcoming educational, financial, and parenting challenges.
This report is a blueprint for how we need to be approaching young parents. What can we do to help them stay in school, continue their learning, and get those jobs that will help provide for their families down the road?
Williams notes the Children Trust of South Carolina just received a two-year grant to continue the Community Support for Young Parents program.
And finally, Eric Tegedoff reports that opponents are lining up now against a measure on Idaho's November ballot that would bring horse racing betting terminals back to the state.
Proposition 1 would allow Idahoans to bet on horse races of years past. Supporters of the machine say they'll help boost interest in a declining horse racing industry and that public schools would receive 0.5% of all betting on the terminals. But opponents, including Idaho legislators such as Senator Brent Hill, mayors, and Northwest tribes, call the measure a bait and switch. Attorney Tyrell Stevenson is legislative director for the Coeur d'Alene tribe.
What this is really about gambling machines, not horses. And many of the concerns that people in opposition to the proposition have are related to the misleading ways that the proposition has been presented to people.
Supporters of the proposition say oversight would be in place to prevent problems and it would create jobs in the state. I'm Mike Clifford. Thanks for newsing and cruising with Public News Service. We are member and listener supported, and we are online at publicnewsservice.org.
The National Weather Service in Albany is predicting rain on Tuesday, up to an inch is possible, with a high near just 60. More rain Tuesday night, showers after 7 p.m., 60% chance, with a low around 60. Wednesday, there's an 80% chance of rain, possibly a thunderstorm after noon, with a high near 71, and a low around 50 Wednesday night as the showers taper off. Thursday should be mostly sunny, with a high near 62 and a low around 50. Tom Rowe for WGXC 90.7 FM, Acre, Catskill, Hudson, listener-supported, Creative Community Radio.
WGXC underwriting support is provided by Pink Zebra, the company that allows you to fragrance your personal space with special sprinkles created from scented soft soy wax. They do home parties, events, one-on-one shopping, and more. Information about Pink Zebra is available at area code 518-567-9420 or online at pinkzebrahome.com/sprinkles from Lacey. Pink Zebra. Change your fragrance. Change your life.
Next, we have an interview from
WOOC.
To learn more about this program, the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org.
WOOC correspondents Julia Kavicki and Trayvon Votrin sat down in the studio with Tyler O'Brien to discuss his work with the Water Resources Institute at Cornell University.
Hi, my name's Felix Yang. I'm a student at Cornell, and this summer I'm working on a project that's primarily concerned with FEMA buyout properties. Basically, it's a federally funded program that targets emergency flooding, emergency hurricane stuff to give funds to communities that were hit hardest by those. So exactly what FEMA buyouts are specifically targeting properties that have been frequently flooded. And once a property is flooded, its housing value typically goes down until eventually it becomes one or so, a dollar or so. And because of the cheapening value, the people that live in these houses typically can't sell their houses and move out because the value keeps spiraling down. So FEMA allows local governments to work with private homeowners to buy out their properties at their original price before the flooding ever happened so that they have the opportunity to move out of their homes. And once that happens, once the local governments own the homes with the funds from FEMA, they are encouraged to use that land productively. And that what that typically means is they encourage it to restore it to its natural habitat. So usually the base is grassland, and from beyond that you can make it into, let's say, a park, make it back into a wetland if possible. But what tends to happen is the house is demolished, and no one does anything with the property because there's typically not enough funding to actually redevelop it. Because what tends to happen is once you lose that house, you also lose a taxing resource for the local government. They can no longer tax that house for the property value. That's the gist of what I'm doing, studying what happens to bought out lands after they are bought out. The people that tend to participate in this are homeowners that continue to live in those properties that flood. That's the reason why they're participating in it, because that's their only home, so they don't really have a choice to live or not to live in there. I assume there are cases where there are vacant properties that are flooded. That might be more commercial than residential, though.
So what have been your primary findings thus far of what happens to those sites?
Okay, so coming into the summer, I did some literature review and found that in one of the documents that I read, that approximately 40% of bought out properties just were vacant lots. Vacant lots meaning just a patch of grass and no impervious surfaces. Impervious meaning no concrete. So things that water is able to soak into the ground in, so typically soil. And that was also the case. So 40% was the biggest category. That was the most common thing found on these bought out properties. And that was also the case in the sites that we were looking at in the cities located in the Susquehanna, such as Binghamton, Johnson City, and Vestal, that in that area.
And what does that mean for how site development goes forward in the future?
So if the studies end up finding that there are a lot of properties that aren't being used most productively, a outreach could be made to both the community but also the local governments to see, like, why aren't you developing this land? Is there anything that the community wants that could be done, like, let's say, build a local park? Or if it's a really big piece of land, perhaps, and it's right next to the river, perhaps build something akin to Dumbo in Brooklyn, New York City, which is a really nice riverfront park that's under the Manhattan Bridge.
So, like, connected with that, like, kind of, like, make, like, boat launches and stuff? Like, if it's, like, a property on the river, can you, like, make kind of, like, whatever you want on that land, or...?
If it's owned by the local government, which the study that I'm doing says that they are, it is completely up to the local government. As long as it... So FEMA, federal government, gives several guidelines to which you can... what kind of stuff you can do in this land. And it typically says you can't redevelop it, so that there's a bunch of concrete... and what that does is you recreate the environment that causes the flooding again, which was you create a lot of surface where all that runoff goes into the river. And if there's more runoff into the river, you swell a river more and more, and you increase the risk of flooding. So if it's a boat launch, I mean, it's possible if you can somehow find a way to incorporate green infrastructure into this boat launch to the point where you're not infringing on the FEMA protocols. It should be okay.
So is there any aspect of sort of community involvement in the design of these sites going forward?
There should be. It's the study... kind of really just started, especially in that particular part of New York, Binghamton, the greater Binghamton area. The community definitely should be involved because that's who's going to use it. It's not going to be people from other communities. And Binghamton is sort of part of the post-industrial America in the sense that there's a lot of people leaving the cities rather than entering it. So this might be an opportunity to redevelop it to the point where it becomes an attraction so that people actually start moving into these parts of America rather than moving out.
Where is this program most effective, and like where is it like not?
It was originally used in, I think it was the Mississippi flood of 1996. And that was an inland river flood. But now it's especially being used in post-Sandy areas in New York City and Jersey, as well as post, I think, Hurricane Irene in 2011. And that's kind of where all the properties that I was looking at in Binghamton were affected. So the most widespread use of this program was probably in New York City and Jersey after Hurricane Sandy, in which I think, if I get the number right, something like 500 homeowners actually participated in the program along Staten Island, because Staten Island was, along with I think Queens, was really heavily affected. And there's this program called, oh man, I don't remember the program, but on the coast, on the side of Jersey, that's close to Staten Island. There's this really effective program that bought out most of the neighborhood in the course of 2 years, 2 or 3 years since Sandy. And that's an example of one of the more successful efforts to participate in this program. And it took a while to begin to build momentum because a lot of people see participating in this program as sort of like a defeat, because we tend to see retreating from environments, from environmental dangers, as a weakness, because humans are supposed to be dominant and kind of have this control over nature. But as climate change worsens, these sort of problems will only become more unpredictable and possibly more intense. So retreating from waterfronts, including coastal and river floodplains, is something that people are becoming more and more open to. And I think that's a good thing, because we should be building on them in the first place. Yeah.
Well, why do we have to retreat? Why can't people just start making more electric cars and stuff like that? And why are we still polluting? You see all this damage that is happening because of all this pollution, and nobody's paying much attention to it.
So we're at a point in history where the damage that's been done is probably not reversible, and what we have to do is kind of mitigate the damage that will come, that is yet to come. So that includes warmer weather and rising sea levels. And it's not to say that we shouldn't take efforts reduce carbon emissions by driving less. And if you drive electric cars. That's not what I'm saying. It's more like, because of what's already been done, because of the already established damages, there are steps that must be taken to ensure that human lives aren't endangered. And they are endangered if you build along at-risk places next to waterfronts.
Well, if we stop, I'm just saying, if we stop now, they're in the future, the future generations, if we stop now, they're going to be better.
Yeah.
And they can probably save, the human race, you know? But right now, we're just we just keep polluting, and then the humans might go extinct because this world is just going to run us right over.
Well, I tend to have a much more positive view of humanity, in a sense that, think about it in history, in the Cold War, when we are on the brink of destroying the entire planet at every step of the way between Soviet Union and United States. But somehow we made it out alive, and that kind of apocalyptic view of things was replaced by climate change. And I mean, in the sense that danger of everything's going to end tomorrow was kind of replaced by climate change. And I'm not saying that it's not unfounded, but I'm saying I believe that there's always hope, and that humans, we're kind of like cockroaches. We'll always find a way out. We'll always live.
Yeah, I believe yeah. that. I believe that.
But yeah, I agree with the sentiment. We definitely should be doing more.
That was Felix Yang speaking with correspondents Trayvon Votrin and Julia Kavicki.
That interview was from
WOOC.
To learn more about this program, the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org.
WGXC underwriting support is provided by the First Presbyterian Church of Hudson, a faith community open to all. Whether you are single, married, divorced, gay, wealthy, poor, or no habla inglés, if you are just browsing, just woke up, or just got out of jail, it doesn't matter if you work on Wall Street or if you sleep on Wall Street. You belong. We love soccer moms, crying babies, vegans, hipsters, seekers and doubters, tourists and locals. All are welcome. Services held Sunday mornings at 10:45 a.m. You can find us on the web at firstpreshudson.org.
Tune in for special programming all week on WGXC. Tuesday, Michael Wilde's Mostly Single show listens to folk oddities at 7 p.m., then the Battlefield Earth show follows. Wednesday, on the WGXC morning show at 9 a.m., Sandra Altomare, the Home Ownership Center Manager for RUPCO Incorporated, discusses the nonprofit housing agency's grant program for Greene County low-income first-time home buyers. Then at 9:30 p.m. on Wednesday, current Wave Farm artist-in-resident Clara Liu brings a dance party to the 90.7 FM airwaves. On Thursday at 10 a.m., we interrupt normal programming for the U.S. Senate hearings with Christine Blasey Ford and Brett Kavanaugh testifying before the U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee through a broadcast through Pacifica Radio. 7 p.m., the Overlook Show looks over the work of Sonny Chirac, and there's an extra web stream Thursday night at 8 p.m. from Hilo and Catskill with Catskill's Rodney Allen Greenblatt performing his electronic music from his new album. Friday on the Hudson Valley Sound at 2 p.m., local musician Ben Smith is featured. Saturday on the Framework Show, Thomas Park is the featured artist. This week on 90.7 FM, WGXC. There are so many events on the WGXC community calendar online at WGXC.org, and you can add your own by pressing the Add an Event button right there on the page. If you do, folks like me will read your community event on the radio. Folks around the world will see it online at WGXC.org, including some of these events. Digital Dancing is at the Hudson Area Library September 25th through September 28th, led by Elena Mosley and the Kumba Dance and Drum Group. It's a three-day performance and media intensive for tweens at the Hudson Area Library. Also Tuesday, September 25th, at the Mountaintop Library in Tannersville, there's a public hearing on the Town of Hunter Comprehensive Plan. That's at 6 p.m. at the Mountaintop Library in Tannersville. Wednesday, September 26th, Drop, Forge, and Tool has a floral design workshop from 6 to 8 p.m. at 442 Warren Street in Hudson. Spike Priggin leads a band with David Chernus on guitar, Andy Chernoff on bass, and Doug Weiland on drums. That's at Hilo in Catskill, 7:30 p.m. Wednesday, September 26th. Rick Winston, the author of the recently published Red Square in the Green Mountains, Vermont in the McCarthy era, 1946 through 1960, speaks at the Hudson Area Library at 6 p.m. Thursday, September 27th. Also that night at Club Helsinki in Hudson, the Von Allman Project and Dwayne Betts perform. Rodney Allen Greenblatt plays selections from his Beep Beep type music album at 8 p.m. Thursday, September 27th at Hilo in Catskill. The next night, Friday, September 28th, Catskill hip-hop artist Dope Bar performs at Hilo in Catskill at 9 p.m. Saturday, September 29th, there's a fall bird migration watch along Mud Creek in Ghent from the Columbia County Soil and Water Conservation District. And the film Thirsty shows at the Crandall Theater Saturday, September 29th. Benefit screening for Wise Bodies with a question and answer period after the film with producer Lisa M. Thomas and the star of the film, Scott Townsend. That's at 1 p.m. Saturday, September 29th. The Caro Development Foundation's Caro Bears Community Art Project auction is at the Crystal Brook Mountain Brow House Saturday, September 29th at 3 p.m. The Fabulous Versatones perform at the Hudson Area Library from 7 to 10 p.m. Saturday, September 29th. For their Fall Fling Swing Dance Party. Also Saturday, September 29th, psych rock bands Tradgrass Ochsteiner and Endless Boogie perform at the Root Cellar in Greenfield, Massachusetts at 8 p.m. These events and more on the WGXC community calendar online at wgxc.org.
Hi, I'm Michael Wilde, host of Mostly Singles, airing every fourth Tuesday of the month at 7 p.m. on WGXC. Maya. I play music I love, mostly 45s, with cuts from obscure collectible LPs, rare 78s, field recordings, and more. Tune in, too, for special guests, international and local artists, musicians extraordinaire. That's Mostly Singles on WGXC 90.7 FM and online at WGXC.org. It's happening.
I'm a Victor Rose's poster. I know he's doing something.
Next, the national headlines from Public News Service.
The Public News Service Daily Newscast for Tuesday, September the 25th.
Thank you.
listening to WGXC 90.7 FM, Accra.
Fridays on WGXC are made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Matt Tombers of Claverick, New York. Sustaining supporters like Matt are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties.
WGXC underwriting support is provided by Mid-Hudson Cable, serving Columbia, Greene, and Southern Albany counties with digital cable, high-speed internet, and cable phone services for homes and businesses since 1971. Mid-Hudson Cable, all the right connections on the web at mhcable.com.
Next, we have these reports.
Hudson Mohawk Magazine correspondent Corinne Carey spoke with Assemblymember Jake Ashby in Freedom Square, the park next to our studio, last week, and brings us this interview with Ashby. On November 6th, Ashby will face his Democratic challenger, Tistra Hufeding, for this seat representing the 107th Assembly District, which covers parts of Albany and Troy, from north of Hoosick Falls to just south of Chatham.
It is a beautiful day in North Troy, and we are out at the park next to the Sanctuary for Independent Media, and I'm joined today by Jake Ashby, our assembly member representing the 107th Assembly District. Thanks for joining me in the park today, Jake.
Thanks for having me.
What motivated your run last April in the special election to replace Assemblymember Steve McLaughlin, who, as we know, left his seat to become the Rensselaer County Executive?
That race, and just like this endeavor into public service, is a call to serve for me. That's why I joined the United States Army, was to serve, and I was asked to do it, and I thought about it. I talked about the whole thing with my family, and after some careful consideration, we decided to make a go of it. But really, it's about public service for me.
You won your assembly seat in last April's special election against Democrat Cindy Duran by a pretty narrow margin. What issues do you think distinguish you from your new Democratic opponent, Tistria Houtling?
I think our backgrounds are very different. I'm a little familiar with New Lebanon. My father used to teach out there. He was an elementary phys ed teacher. But I know she is the New Lebanon town clerk, so she has a little bit of a record in public service, but I think my background as a small business owner, as a clinician in healthcare, as a public servant through the United States Army, and some of the things that I did, you know, while I was in the service, distinguish us a little bit just in terms of our experience and levels of dedication.
On your assembly website, you name the following priorities: improve higher education, protect our veterans, lower taxes, and bring an influx of people into New York State. I'd like to talk about each one of those in a little bit of detail. What does the state need to do to improve higher education?
I think we need to look at how we are educating our students and what we're doing to hold them accountable at times while they're in school. We need to look at the funding. I see this as a college instructor at Maria College, the census that we currently have with our students coming in and the funding that they're getting for this, the Excelsior Scholarship, for example, has had some mixed results. And I think we need to examine that. I think we need to look at the ways that we are instructing in college these days. Online education, for example, has been very popular with people, but I think...
Good thing or a bad thing?
I think in some instances it certainly is a good thing because it provides people more access. But I also think that you lose an element of, obviously, personability. And in some areas of instruction, I think it's imperative that you do have face-to-face. In my experience as an occupational therapist and instructing people or students on this topic... It's important to have that.
Protecting our veterans. Can you say more specifically about what you have in mind?
I think as lawmakers across the board, as whether it's state or federal, even down to the county level, I think we need to be aware and more cognizant of what our veterans have done while they were serving, and then when they come back, the reintegration process, what that's like and what they're encountering. I was fortunate to have a very strong support system, and I'll tell you what, it's not easy. It's still not easy, and I failed numerous failures. But without my support system, without people there, I wouldn't be here where I am today. So the people that don't have that safety net, I mean, those are the 22 a day that we hear about and that we read about. And
by the 22 a day, you mean the
veteran suicides. And, yes. You know, the studies that have been out there across the board point to an age gap that, you know, it's more significant in that Vietnam veteran population than it is the younger ones. But it's still there. It's still prevalent. And I think we need to take a look at that and how we're serving them, making sure that we are doing our utmost. I think a lot of times when we get complaints, federal representatives kind of throw their hands up in the air and say, oh, well, it's the VA. And, you know, the level of bureaucracy there is unprecedented. But what are we really doing? I mean, how are we really pushing for these men and women that have laid down their lives for us?
There's a record number of veterans running this year. Why do you think that is?
I think it's a call to public service. I think when you get veterans that are coming back home, they want to be a part of something bigger than themselves because that's what they got used to, and that was their call to serve, and it's a genuine interest, and I applaud them for doing it.
Few of us would say that we don't grimace when we look at our tax bill. How do you plan to balance the needs of our communities in terms of infrastructure, social services, and the like, against the need to reduce taxes? I mean, we have a particular problem here in Troy and Lansingburg with the number of tax-exempt entities taking up so much space, namely the churches and the universities. What are some of your ideas?
I think economic growth is imperative in helping to reduce the taxes. I think there's a number of people who are eligible for certain services around the state that our tax dollars go towards, and I think that's sometimes a necessary thing. I think we need to take a hard look at the quality of those services and what we're getting out of them. But I think we also need to look at the state of New York in terms of it being business friendly, retirement friendly, and you know, the numbers that we're seeing right now don't add up to that. They're not representative of a place that is business friendly or retirement friendly. In fact, they're ranked in the worst among all the states in our country. So what are we doing to make those improvements, you know, at a local level and at a state level and a federal level?
There's been a lot of growth in businesses in downtown Troy. Do you have any ideas for how to bring it north here in North Troy and in Lansingburg?
Taking a look at the growth in South Troy and trying to bring it or to other areas, I think could serve as a good template, but being able to serve the people in this area, knowing what their needs are, we need to make this area more business friendly. I think security is part of that. You know, speaking as an Army veteran and serving in areas where we were trying to do just that, provide basic needs for people, security was imperative with that. And we've seen a spike in violence across the Capital District recently. And I think we should go back and revisit maybe some of those provisions, some of those laws that are supposed to be keeping us safe, and act accordingly as a community to make sure that it gets better.
We're talking with Jake Ashby out here on a sunny Wednesday afternoon. Jake is the incumbent and Republican candidate for the 107th District State Assembly seat. Ashby will face his Democratic opponent, Histria Houtling, in the midterm general election on November 6th. Jake, the state Senate is going to face some serious and seriously contentious issues in the coming year, and I'd like to ask you about just a few of them. The Reproductive Health Act. We are seeing a moment right now with the confirmation process with maybe soon to be Justice Brett Kavanaugh, and I think it's creating a conversation around reproductive rights here in New York. In the past, people have said that New York has a pretty strong abortion law and we don't need to change it because our rights are protected at the federal level by Roe versus Wade. Some people are saying that the landscape has changed and we need to revisit our laws here in New York. What are your thoughts about the Reproductive Health Act?
Well, I'm pro-life, staunchly pro-life. But I think in New York State, the abortion rates that we have in this state exceed maybe what people had thought of abortion before as kind of, you know, only if necessary or in rare cases. I think the frequency of abortions that we see and the laws that frankly allow that aren't necessarily reflective in what people are thinking to be Roe versus Wade becoming endangered. I think it's worth taking a harder look at that, but I would be very surprised if there were any changes in New York State that would imbalance that.
What about healthcare access? Do you see the need for state action around increasing access to healthcare coverage?
I think when we take a look at healthcare in general, we've seen a profound increase in access throughout the state and throughout the country. And when you have an increase in access, it also affects two other things. It affects costs and it affects quality. And we've seen that become imbalanced as well. I think before we go forward with really pushing this need for access, we need to look at the programs that we have here that are in place that are already providing increased access, the quality of those programs, the cost of those programs, and whether or not we're going in the right direction. I'm not certain we are. And it's starting to bleed over into other areas of healthcare, and it's going to continue to do so until we do examine those issues.
School funding. Advocates have pointed out that there is an extreme disparity from school district to school district in the amount of funding available for things as basic as textbooks, extracurricular activities, and basic education. What are your thoughts about evening out school funding in this district?
I'm a firm believer in home rule, and I think that those districts should be implementing whatever guidelines or protocols or provisions that they need to in order to maintain or increase the funding that they desire. I know that it's not just for public schools. I, you know, was speaking with people from private schools and from for schools for troubled youth that are encountering similar issues. And then it becomes a game of trying to access or get funding from third parties and whether or not it's fair or who's paying for it. And it's a huge issue across the board. And, you know, I think as lawmakers, we are called to make sure that things are equitable in some sense of it. But is the system that we currently have in place the right way to be doing it? I think we need to take a look at that. What areas around here are actually growing? Why aren't they growing? Why aren't we attracting new families to come in here and get that increase in funding that we so desperately need? That goes back to, you know, questions that we just talked about. Those are the things that I think we need to be looking at.
There's a bill called the Medical Aid in Dying Act. It passed the Assembly Health Committee 2 years ago, but it hasn't gotten a vote in the full Assembly. Are you familiar with the bill? It would allow terminally ill, mentally capable adults to ask their doctor for a prescription that they can take at a time of their choosing to bring about a peaceful death. Some folks know it as death with dignity. Where do you stand on that issue?
I think the government's role in healthcare as a whole has kind of gone too far in certain areas. You know, this being one of them. I think people certainly should have the right to access not only medications for terminal illnesses, but for a lot of other illnesses that have a poor diagnosis. ALS, for example, it is terminal, but sometimes you can live a number of years having it, and they don't have access to medication that they need, whereas in other countries, you know, they do. So along with the Death with Dignity bill, I think we should be taking a look at that.
When you're not running to represent the residents of the 107th Assembly District, what do you enjoy doing?
I enjoy spending time with my family. I've got two young children that are involved in sports and a number of other activities, and I try and spend as much time as I can with them. I used to enjoy fishing and hiking and sports and things like that, but I haven't had the opportunity to really enjoy them as much as I have in the past. I'm a bit of a musician. I kind of dabble in that too, so.
You are. There's so many candidates around this area that are musicians. What do you play?
I play percussion. I play a couple string instruments, and my dad has a local band, and you know, I try and support them as best I can. I'm by no means the talent that they are, but you know, it's fun to just kind of jam with them.
What's your dad's band's name, and where does he play?
It's they're Gone Gray, and they play at some local bars. They go around to actually a lot of the aging community around here, senior centers, and that sort of thing, and they play there, and they're a great great group.
If you could name one thing, one event, one situation in your past that best prepared you for the role of assembly member representing this district, what would it be?
When I was a young child, my mother worked nights at a nursing home, Resurrection Nursing Home. And she would come home late. And in the morning, sometimes we'd go back to the nursing home. And, you know, as a kid, that kind of stuff is sometimes foreign to you, the environment. But engaging with the people there who had kind of been overlooked and lost, and maybe they didn't have the support system that they had, you know, I think for me was a call to serve at a young age. And, you know, my mother always supported that and has always been, you know, kind of a guiding light in this endeavor for me. So I think that would probably be one of the biggest events in my life. I know that there's a lot of political division out there right now throughout the state and, you know, throughout the country, but know that, you know, my intentions to serve are genuine. You know, I'm not doing this for any other reason than that. I'm grateful to be able to do this. I hope that everybody gets out there and exercises their right to vote on November 6th.
It is a beautiful day in North Toronto.
That was Jake Ashby, Republican Assemblymember representing the 107th District or Assembly District in the state legislature, speaking with Hudson Mohawk Magazine correspondent Corinne Carey. Ashby will face his Democratic challenger, Tristria Hotling, in the general election on November 6th.
Tune in Tuesday. We'll go live to Catskill at 11 a.m. The Forgotten Geek, Corey McClassland.
Here's Corey with another edition.
Then Neva Wartell brings you Music for the Masses at noon after the news. Bob Hoven, the president of the Friends of B.D. Powers Place, 178-year-old Catskill estate, is the guest with Jack Sagenbaugh on Backtracks in Time at 2 p.m. Then Catskill musician Rodney Allen Greenblatt previews his show at Hilo in Catskill Thursday, September 27th, and the release of his beep beep type music. At 4 p.m. on the WGXC afternoon show.
From the WGXC newsroom, this is the WGXC Hands-On Radio News Update. I'm Philip Grant. Bill Mahoney is reporting for Politico New York. Women are running for office in record numbers in legislative races in New York this year. The names of 105 women will appear on major party lines for 213 seats in the state legislature, a 22% increase from the 86 who ran in 2016 and significantly more than the 91 who ran in 2006. The increase has been notable among Democrats. The party's 196 legislative candidates include 80 women, an increase from 62 years ago. In the state Senate, 44% of the Democratic candidates are women, the closest any legislative conference in state history has come to creating a ticket with an even gender balance. Among Republicans, the number of female candidates decreased from 26 to 25. This year, 13 of the 99 GOP candidates for assembly seats are women. The mobilization of women is likely to have an impact on the priorities of state government. Assemblymember Nili Rozek, a Queens Democrat and the youngest woman ever elected to the Assembly, said, and I quote, "There's a direct correlation between women candidates who run and the issues that are discussed and advocated for. Things like the Reproductive Health Act and pay equity will be more prevalent in campaigns if there are women candidates talking about it," end quote. The number of women running for office in New York this year mirrors a national trend, particularly on the Democratic line. The trend appears to be driven in part by a frustration with the federal government. Read the full story at politico.com. New York has been ranked the best state for teachers nationwide by the personal finance website WalletHub. The state ranked first overall, second for spending per student, fourth for teachers' income growth potential, and fifth for average teacher salary. The report, released September 24th, ranked New York, Connecticut, Minnesota, Illinois, and North Dakota as the top states where teachers are fairly paid and treated based on 22 key indicators of teacher friendliness. The five worst states for teachers: Hawaii, Arizona, North Carolina, Louisiana, and Florida. A link to the full report can be found on the newsroom page at WGXC.org. Ken Lovett is reporting for the Daily News. Gubernatorial candidate Mark Molinaro has created a website for state workers who wish to report wrongdoing within the Cuomo administration. The Tivoli Republican said he created CuomoLeaks.com after receiving tips on various issues from whistleblowers afraid to come forward for fear of retribution from the governor and his aides. Molinari said that includes information related to the opening of the second span of the Tappan Zee Bridge just days before the Democratic gubernatorial primary. On the site, tipsters have an option of remaining anonymous. They can also upload supporting documents. Cuomo spokeswoman Liz Smith called Molinaro's website, and I quote, the latest desperate gimmick, end quote, from Molinaro's, and I quote, flailing campaign, end quote. John Campbell is reporting for Loud.com. Molinaro may have his own ethics problem. According to a pair of television advertisements unveiled by the Cuomo campaign last week, the employment of Molinaro's wife, Connie Adams, by Tinkleman Brothers Development Corp., was part of a pay-to-play scheme involving tax breaks handed down by the Dutchess County Industrial Development Agency, contributions to Molinaro's campaign, and Adams' employment. Molinaro responded, saying his wife, and I quote, earned her way of this world, end quote, and accused Cuomo of, and I quote, being born on third base and attempting to convince everyone he hit a triple, end quote. According to Campbell, the issue is likely to remain a talking point in Cuomo's campaign through the November 6 election. The Mid-Hudson News Network is reporting Ulster County Sheriff's deputies are now wearing body cameras. The agency previously deployed dashboard cameras in patrol vehicles. The body cam program began August 20th and is now fully operational, the official reported. They record interactions with the public in addition to the dash cams in each patrol vehicle. The black body cams are worn on the chest of the outermost clothing of each deputy and measure 3 inches by 2 inches. Read the full story in the Daily Freeman. And that wraps up the WGXC Hands-On Radio News Update. For local weather reports, public meetings, and other community information, use the WGXC website, WGXC.org.
The National Weather Service in Albany is predicting rain on Tuesday, up to an inch is possible, with a high near just 60. More rain Tuesday night, showers after 7 p.m., 60% chance, with a low around 60. Wednesday, there's an 80% chance of rain, possibly a thunderstorm after noon, with a high near 71, and a low around 50 Wednesday night as the showers taper off. Thursday should be mostly sunny, with a high near 62 and a low around 50. Tom Rowe for WGXC 90.7 FM, Acre, Catskill, Hudson, listener-supported, creative community radio.
The Albany Times Union reports that David R. Smith, the former president of Upstate Medical University in Syracuse, pleaded guilty to 3 counts of official misconduct on Monday. Smith admitted he secretly boosted his annual pay by nearly $29,000 and used unauthorized expenses to increase his $5,000 a month housing allowance. Smith also submitted expense receipts for reimbursements he was not entitled to receive in order to augment his monthly housing allowance. In addition, he illegally set up a deferred compensation plan for himself and others, not yet identified by authorities, from MedBest Medical Management, Inc., a company that provided billing services for the Upstate Medical University Hospital and its physicians.
Snapchat and Amazon announced a partnership Monday that will allow users to point their phones and products using the Snapchat app and be redirected to an Amazon link for the same or a similar product. Snapchatters using the feature will be taken to the Amazon app, where they can then purchase the item being photographed. The feature is currently available to a small number of users in the U.S., Bloomberg reports, and could help generate revenue for Snapchat. The company hit a record low in its share price at the beginning of the month, but saw a 5% uptick following Monday's announcement. It's unclear whether Snapchat will receive revenue from Amazon for any purchases made, Bloomberg reports.
For the third year, CDTA is teaming up with the American Cancer Society's Real Men Wear Pink campaign. As part of the initiative, pink buses are rolling on Capital Region streets to raise awareness and support the campaign. Napa Auto Parts and Lamar Advertising donated materials and decals to transform the city buses, which are hard to miss. Last year, the Capital District Transportation Authority raised more than $146,000, ranking fourth in the nation after Atlanta, Boston, and Pittsburgh.
The Troy Record reports that Timothy Walton, a 48-year-old Waterville resident, was sentenced to 4 years in state prison, followed by 2 years post-release supervision for drug sales, according to Rensselaer County District Attorney Joel Abelov. Walton entered a guilty plea to one count of attempted criminal sale of a controlled substance in the third degree, a Class C felony, on August 27th of this year. Officials said Walton was indicted on six felony counts for three separate drug transactions in the city of Troy. The record did not identify the type or quantity of drugs involved, according to District Attorney Abelov. At the time of these drug sales, Walton was on 5 years probation for a felony driving while intoxicated conviction out of Albany County.
Next, we have these reports.
Hudson Mohawk Magazine correspondent Corinne Carey spoke with Assemblymember Jake Ashby in Freedom Square, the park next to our studio, last week, and brings us this interview with Ashby. On November 6th, Ashby will face his Democratic challenger, Tistri Hufeding, for this seat representing the 107th Assembly District, which covers parts of Albany and Troy, from north of Hoosick Falls to just south of Chatham.
It is a beautiful day in North Troy, and we are out at the park next to the Sanctuary for Independent Media, and I'm joined today by Jake Ashby, our assembly member representing the 107th Assembly District. Thanks for joining me in the park today, Jake.
Thanks for having me.
What motivated your run last April in the special election to replace Assemblymember Steve McLaughlin, who, as we know, left his seat to become the Rensselaer County Executive?
That race, and just like this endeavor into public service, is a call to serve for me. That's why I joined the United States Army, was to serve, and I was asked to do it, and I thought about it. I talked about the whole thing with my family, and after some careful consideration, we decided to make a go of it. But really, it's about public service for me.
You won your assembly seat in last April's special election against Democrat Cindy Duran by a pretty narrow margin. What issues do you think distinguish you from your new Democratic opponent, Tistria Houtling?
I think our backgrounds are very different.
There is nothing wrong with your television set. Do not attempt to adjust the picture. We are controlling transmission. If we wish to make it louder, we will bring up the volume. If we wish to make it softer, we will tune it to a whisper. We will control the horizontal. We will control the vertical. We can roll the image, make it flutter. We can change the focus to a soft blur or sharpen it to crystal clarity. For the next hour, sit quietly and we will control all that you see and hear. We repeat, there is nothing wrong with your television set. You are about to participate in a great adventure. You are about to experience the awe and mystery which reaches from the inner mind to the outer limits.
This is Echo. You are listening to WJFC Acra, Creative Community Magical Radio.
I'm a rogue.